continuing on side two of tape two.
I'm not. Are you ready to go?
Yes, we're ready.
Yes, we're.
I'm not sure there's any prescription you can write down that by reading this, you know exactly what the relationship is. I think it's more subtle than that. And the only test is whether in time you succeeded or you failed. And so I do not know how to articulate actions you take that will ensure that this will happen, see. And that's why I have to leave it somewhat fuzzy. I don't want to leave it fuzzy like Ollie North, but
just as an aside, right, during the course of the interviews we've done during this recent several months, we must have a reference to Ollie North on just about every day.
Every day, no doubt. It's just yeah.
I'm wondering what you saw as the aircraft people saw as the use of these generalized state of the art studies.
All right. Now, after I had been engulfed in these things for about 2 years, say, I began to feel like I wanted to be a project leader. What does that mean? Okay. And I'd heard about all this interdisciplinary research, even from Gene Root way back and so on. All right. But I hadn't seen it really. See, I got my feet on the ground for 2 years, and then I barged forth. And I managed to join forces with an economist, Stephen Inke. I don't know whether that name has cropped up anywhere. Stephen Inke and I were co-project leaders on a project that had to do now with taking, for instance, an Air Force strategic mission. Now, what's a strategic mission? Now, you see, the nuclear weapons had been not fully developed, but I mean, we were in the nuclear era by now. And we had the physics department with all of the nuclear stuff, see. Therefore, a lot of us had to go through the Q clearance system and so on, see. But what the project consisted of, studying what would be the most effective or cost-effective way for Strategic Air Command, for instance, to be able to accomplish its mission, and what can we say about the policies concerning what kind of aircraft development they should have, not yet to the ballistic missile era, see, should have, and why, what do you need to know in order to do that? If that's the objective of the thing, see. So we entered into this project. He's an economist. I was the engineer and had done some of these generalized studies.
If we could back up just mm-hmm. a little bit. What I'd like to know is how the idea of the study arose and how you got hooked up with the economist and whether you tried other possibilities.
You forced me, all right, I wasn't going to do it this early, but you forced me into telling you about that thing on the wall out there. Now, this was started before we moved into this building. But we were scattered in
4th Street. There was
three buildings. There was one building and one across the street and one over there. This started. It may have been it was finished in this building. See, this building was finished, I think, in 1953. And where am I? 2 years, 51, and maybe so. It was finished. Project may have been finished in this building. I guess the point I want to illustrate by this is that we got these people in this corporation, and it doesn't do any good if they all sit in their offices or sit in their conference rooms and just talk with each other and do work together with each other. You'll have no interdisciplinary So action. So you want some interaction between people of different disciplines. How did we do that? Well, it seems like a simple-minded way, but I think John Williams actually invented the idea, propounded the idea. He says, we promote all the time that we want everybody in Rand to get acquainted. We want you to walk around the halls and talk to John Doe and Richard Rowe and everybody, the sociologists, the economists, and you don't know what to talk about, but you got to learn what to talk about. See, you haven't done it before, but you got to learn. You got to talk and co-mingle this way, see. So, as you now can begin to see, we had terrible trouble. The economists were in one building, and I was in another building, and we'd go across the street and so on, and that was difficult and so on. But in planning this building, it was certainly the plan of it was started about that time, see. John Williams says, look, he got persuaded, Rand and the architects, let's make this building such that you have hallways that maximize, now there's a mathematician, see, that maximize the communication between people that are in the halls. Passing, if nothing more, see. Well, that's going around this way, see. If everybody's got to go around this way, so everybody's got to meet. So here's another cell over here, and everybody goes around that way. And finally, you can make a figure eight, and you can make that. This building, with patios in the middle and all those little checkerboard things, was deliberately, finally designed, and even the architect may not know it, but Rand wanted it that way. John Williams, I think, had the idea. It's to maximize communications among disciplines. Now, you know, maybe somebody's set in his ways and he goes down one path and back, see, but this is the only way you make a building do that. But there was everybody was yearning to do this anyway, see. And that's why this building was done. So, all right, I had gotten acquainted with many of the economists. I knew Charlie Hitch, I knew all the heads of the departments immediately, say, and talked with them a lot, and I knew a number of the economists, and Steve Inke and I were talking. Well, it turned out he was yearning to want to do something that he could do with economic expertise that was related to sort of the mission of the Strategic Air Command. And so did I. So we got to talking, how can we do this, see? So the idea emerged. I says, okay, I can figure out how to present, in other words, an array of aircraft capabilities, not aircraft, but the capabilities of aircraft, or an array of those capabilities. But all I can do is present the array. Here they are. I say, so what? I know that cost is going to bear on it, so now, Steve, what do you say? Ah, the light begins to dawn. You know, I can take economics and find out where you can localize. How can you optimize, in a sense, between physical array of things, and by physical in this sense, it's on a piece of paper graph, say, physical array, and the interesting places in that array that you want to study. You can't don't study them all, see what I mean? So we then talk about cost. Then we introduce the cost. We had this cost data. They were working on that sort of as background data. And by and large, not all, but most of the cost people were economists. They were in the economics department originally. That's how we got together. That's how it got started. Then he drew in some more economists. A little help, although he went on to other things bigger than that. Pretty soon you may have heard Albert Wallstetter. There he was, see. He was a big strategic man too, see. But Steve, he was sort of advisor, if you like, see what I mean. But Steve Inke and I were the project leaders, and there was some economists by way of mostly cost people he had working on this, and also I had some other engineers on it. together we put together the things that had to be processed in the computer to do it. Now, the upshot of all of that, I'd like to think anyway, was the following. It had, I'm not sure where this particular study did it, it was talked about, but the first one, but studies of this nature then, maybe it's been a subsequent one, resulted in a profound change in the Air Force, I think. Now, I'll go back and say, immediately after World War II, we had the nuclear weapon stuff, and SAC was terribly overburdened with the fact that how in the world are we going to deal with this, and we don't have missiles now. And so what did they have? They had things like the B-36, you remember, things like that. How can we have intercontinental bombing? We can't. We can't fly from here to there. So now we have to go into the NATO arena, and we get all sorts of overseas bases. We find ourselves there. They're sacked with overseas bases. Vulnerability of overseas bases was there. It was in Europe, not here, and so on. The B-36 wasn't particularly useful for that, but shorter range things. Okay. Out of these studies came the fact that convinced SAC and the Air Force that there was a way to skin this cat that was not the overseas bases, their vulnerability, to get rid of them. That invented the thing called aerial refueling, right out of those studies. There was no aerial refueling for, and you know, the idea seems simple these days, but it's very simple for engineers to find out how much you can extend the range if you can increase the fuel, and even you got to see the refueler has to go out and it has to come back, but it's got to have some excess fuel that can transfer and all that stuff. So the state of the art of all that with tanker stuff was can be built into this thing and was. And I think I want to, you know, show, you know, you got another section in here where you talk about what effects did you have on the outcome of working for the Air Force and so on. I like to think, I don't know whether everybody does, that that was the equivalent of, not technological, but the equivalent of the tactical invention of refueling. And what about it? We don't have any such strategic overseas bases anymore. And they were long since gotten. And that was an enormous boost to the Air Force.
We're going to have to bring this to a close in a little bit. I know for sure that we are not going to be able to finish talking about this study.
I just finished this study. I was ready to go on to something else. But
no, I'm afraid I have a few questions about this.
And, all right.
I don't think that we're going to be able to really do it justice.
Yeah. Let's just quickly ask on this project. Joe's right. I think there are several questions we might want to bring up here. What was Albert Volstetter's role in this?
He was mostly a drop-in, look-over-your-shoulder consultant, kind of.
But you and Enke were the driving
the
force.
He is not listed on the report as an author. He may have been given, you know, credit in where a preface or something about consultation and advice or something, say. But I think it's just, as I recall, Steve Enkins and my name on the report. See?
Okay. I want to go back just a little bit to the early generalized studies that you did. What value did the aircraft industry find in these reports that you prepared?
I'm not sure that I could say they found a great deal of value in them, because they are oriented more to designing specific points, see, around specific points. And to have the generalized studies, I'm not sure that they got a great deal of value. Now, there may have been some technological value in the fact that in here are formulas, you know, out of all this developed formulas that allow you to produce a study, and maybe the aircraft industry people are searching for the best thing to propose for the Air Force, or even for commercial aircraft, I don't know.
Well, if there's an ambiguity about their value to the aircraft industry, what did you think their value was?
The value, that's why I tried to illustrate, the value is this tremendous thing it did for the Air Force. And it didn't have to do with specific airplanes. It facilitated the making of this other study, this Inca Rump study,
okay,
that involved refueling, see? But it took that background of all that generalized study to run up and down the scale to find what mixes could be put together to minimize, you know, the cost, if you like, to generate certain missions.
Okay. We probably don't have, I'm still a little bit confused about what goes into a generalized study and what's covered, and perhaps that would be a better way to start off our next session because of that. I'm not exactly
all right,
clear on that. One thing that comes to mind, perhaps you can think about, these things where you characterize them as state-of-the-art studies.
Yeah.
I'm wondering, you mentioned the refueling. I mean, the refueling thing was essentially something that was an innovation that was not part of the state-of-the-art.
Well, it became that, though, once it was introduced, see?
Okay.
What
okay.
is state-of-the-art? It's a sort of a film. In other words, state-of-the-art really means what is the best that mankind has invented, and how can you describe it, see? You describe it in certain technical terms, like I give you this Breguet equation thing, say. In other words, that's a matter of commingling the parts. You take these state-of-the-art elements, which is the best we've invented for engines or for design weights or for aerodynamics, the best minds have invented, and when you put it together in this generalized study, that's what makes it state-of-the-art. It's the elements that have gone in it are state-of-the-art. Now, obviously, some bright genius will invent something maybe tomorrow that no man has thought of, see, particularly. And now I've changed the state of the art, see, and refueling changed the state of the art. But I guess the mental view of what we were looking at here was enhanced to the point that allowed the notion of refueling to get invented, see. I wouldn't say, but theoretically I could hypothesize it had never been invented, would not for that, but I don't believe it, see. In other words, some other thing might have happened that you would invent it, see. We've had, I don't know whether before that time or not, we've had all these long endurance flights, you know, just records you're trying to set. I've been up there 7 days or something, and you go, airplanes keep going up and down and refueling them. There's the concept right there. See, they're not going anywhere. They're just trying to make a record, see. This was with a purpose. The purpose was, we know the geography of the Earth is from so much, if you got to get to Russia, for instance. So we got to have that range, whatever it is. And we can't cause one airplane. The state of the art is not good enough to allow one airplane to be made to fly that far. How can I stretch that? See, that so now that it's ripe to invent something, see, and that's what comes forward.
Okay. So just to characterize and tell me this is wrong, the state-of-the-art study lays a foundation for kind of forward-looking to see what needs to be done.
That's right. It is. It's, you know, the state-of-the-art only tells you a benchmark of where you are. You've already invented all that stuff, see. But it shows up where you're deficient, and can't, I just wished I could do this, but I can't do it with this study, see? That makes it propitious to put the mind to work to try to invent some way to skin the cat, see?
Okay.
You can't meet the mission, see?
Okay. Why don't we...
Now, you don't always invent that, see? I'm just trying to say that was sort of the one or prime example I could think of in the whole history of the Iran aircraft business and so on. To me, is most outstanding, see.
Why don't we call it a day then?
Okay.
Thank you very much.
Thank you. This is
and I don't know, I mean, you will, if I... talk and get enthusiastic about what I'm saying, I may get long-winded. So don't think a minute for sake. Cut it out. Stop. Slow up. See.
This is precisely what we want.
Well, all right.
You don't know for people who do oral history.
There's a time when you got to go somewhere else, though. You haven't got all eternity
right.
to
we
do
We don't have all eternity, that's right. It's a cost benefit. All right. But so often we do interviews where individuals find it difficult to talk about the activities that they've done. And it's more of an effort on our part to, you know,